Welcome to Enemies of the People. A podcast about extremism in the 21st century. In this episode, we are continuing with our theme of history as stories of power. Today we are talking with journalist Andrew Scott, who writes under the pen name Otto English, about his new book Fake History, 10 Great Lies and How They Shaped the World. As I edited today's episode, I kept on thinking of this line from one of my favorite musicals. Where I'm from, we believe in all sorts of things that aren't true. We call it history. Andrew's book does an incredible job at exposing how much of what we believe happened in the past actually didn't, and how much of our history is based on lies. So without further ado, here is Andrew.
My name is Andrew Scott, and I write under the pseudonym Otto English, and I write journalism. I do a little bit of video making, and I send too many tweets on Twitter.
And you've recently written a book, Fake History.
Yes, so I've recently written a book, Fake History, which was not the original title. So the book was a bit looser than that, and I was sort of reined in by the publisher and asked to identify sort of 10 great lies and then knock them down, if you like. But that what I've tried to do is I've tried to riff on the lies more than just tackle the lies, because I think that's more interesting. So I sort of approached it almost like a jazz project. I thought I'll take the lie and then I'll see what themes I can draw out of those lies and how I can play around with them and what parallels I can find elsewhere. So that's what I've done, sort of journey through the last 4,000 or 5,000 years in 320 pages.
I think it's great. I really enjoyed it. It really was fascinating because a lot of the things are things that we take for granted. Like, for example, the keep calm and carry on poster. Yeah. I always assumed that it was something that was around during the 1940s and 1930s. But as you say in the book, it's a much, much more recent and modern creation. And I had no idea.
Yeah, so that poster was created during the war, but they never actually used it. So it was. I think the person discovered it, bought like a job lot of posters from some government office that had never been used and found all these keep calm and carry on posters, and then started, I think it was around 2000-2001, because it dovetailed with 9/11. So suddenly keep calm and carry on became this misremembered slogan of war, which had never actually been used. Oh yes, keep calm and carry on. I'm sure, just as many elderly people claimed they remembered hearing Churchill making his famous 1940 speech on "We will fight on the beaches," that was never broadcast at the time, so they couldn't have heard that. And in the same way, people misremember the past, they or imagine that things happened that didn't happen.
Your chapter on the war was one of the ones I enjoyed the most, because I think it articulated something that a lot of people have been grappling with for a while now, which is this idea, as you say in the book, that Britain has a very unhealthy and dangerous relationship with World War II. And it seems that a lot of the mythos of Britishness and British identity, especially I would say English identity, is built around the Second World War.
Yes, there's an unhealthy, I would say unhinged, obsession in this country with World War II. And it's been there all of my life. And it's got worse, I think, in a weird way, because the people who were alive during the war are now mostly gone, particularly the people who took part in the actual action. So, in fact, my own father fought in the Second World War. My father, I was born when my father was in his 50s. So that generation is not so far back. Those people didn't bang on about the war all the time. On the contrary, you had to draw it out of them. They were reluctant to talk about it. And there was no sort of jingoistic, heroic narrative to it. It was just something they'd been engaged in and that had happened and that had interrupted their young lives. So I think the weaponization of World War II and to some extent World War I, and the whole poppy thing, and what I call in the book, and what people now call War Christmas around November, when everybody goes into this sort of cultish remembrance for something that nobody remembers is utterly, utterly bizarre and a bit worrying. But if you try to rebalance it, or if you try and bring some reason or nuance to it, you get called a traitor, or you get told you don't love your country, or you get told that you're wrong, or you get told that the people who died in those two world wars died for you, which is all nonsense. But then all of that imagery and messaging comes into Brexit, even into the pandemic. You know, at the start of the pandemic, people were going, British people have this Blitz spirit. We will get through it. We're imbued with this inherent sort of DNA of exceptional behavior and our stiff upper lips and resolve. And you know, Boris Johnson then had his whole thing about getting Rolls-Royce involved in making ventilators, and it's all such bullshit, you know. And it's not unique to the British Isles, but I think we've got a particularly bad case of it at the moment.
On the subject of the puppy, I don't wear one, and I can't tell you how many times I've been accosted by people randomly on the street, on the tube, to ask me why I'm not wearing a puppy.
Yeah.
And first of all, who cares? But clearly people do care a lot. And I remember once was one of these old ladies that was selling the puppies right outside a tube station. She, you know, came up to me and I said, no, thank you. And she looked at me up and down and she said, don't worry, dear, you can still wear one if you're a foreigner. And I said, I don't remember what I said at the time, but I know what I thought. My thought was, I'm not a foreigner. I'm British. I just have a weird accent and have multiple nationalities. But it was such a stark illustration of the boundary that the puppy represents, you know, the very clear boundary of us versus them. And in order to be part of us, of this we need to buy into this mythology.
Yeah, I mean, there's a thing which I put in the book about 5 years ago. I wrote an article for The Independent on exactly that subject. You know, if people want to remember the dead by wearing a poppy, or want to make a donation to the Royal British Legion, good for them. Yeah. But it should not become some patriotic badge, if you like. Or, you know, it's like, I belong to this country more because I'm sadder, or I'm remembering harder, or all of those things. And I was invited, after I wrote this piece, onto all sorts of radio stations, you know, like LBC and BBC London. And I was invited onto Three Counties Radio. And I thought, that's an easy thing. And I went on, and they said to me, do you mind taking some calls from listeners? And I said, thinking, you know, I grew up in the home counties. I grew up in Essex. I know that radio station from childhood. The first person to call in was a man probably in his 60s or 70s. So he wouldn't have fought in the Second World War, possibly had been a baby during the Second World War or born shortly after. And pretty quickly, he suggested I should be shot. Both my grandfathers fought in the First World War. My father fought in the Second. My father wore his medals once in his life. And that was in 1995, when there was a last march for like the old soldiers, people who had been in the Second World War through the centre of London to commemorate 50 years. And my father finally had his medals put on a pin, and he wore them through London because all of his comrades were. That was the first time I ever wore them. There was none of that. And my father was a conservative. You know, he was a conservative councillor. You could not have been a more sort of patriotic person. You know, the behaviour, the excuse of behaviour, questioning people's countries of origins, suggesting people should be shot. It's the poppy is no longer about remembrance. It's a weapon of identity and of nationalist belief, and that's extremely dangerous.
I believe it was in how you ended your chapter on the war, where you say that nationalism can lead to acts of monstrous self-sabotage. And right next to it, I wrote Brexit. Did you mean Brexit when you said a monstrous act of self-sabotage?
Yeah. It is a monstrous act of self-sabotage. You know, and the whole process of joining the European Union, which you could write, I'm sure people have written entire books on it, was as a result of Britain's part in the Second World War, and the people who overwhelmingly voted to join the European, the EEC in the early 70s in that referendum, they, or remain in it, to be more technical. Those people had all lived through the war to a large extent. Most of those adults had been there in the threat. So these people who say, we should never have joined the EEC, it's a betrayal of everyone's sacrifice during World War II, those people took us in. You know, people like Edward Heath had served with some distinction in the Second World War. These were not traitors. These were a very interesting thing, actually. The people who opposed entry into the EEC, the most vocal voices on the left and the right, almost to a man, well, man and woman, had not seen active duty in the Second World War. It's an absolutely fascinating detail that they were the people who had actually been there were very vociferous. The people who had been at D-Day, who were then became politicians, even quite right-wing figures, were very keen on us joining the EC because they thought it'd be good for the economy, but they also didn't want a third wave. They didn't want a third war. They believed in building consensus between nations in Western Europe, and it works. You know, it was very, membership of the EU was very good for Britain. And if it hadn't been, I think anybody who loves this country and who loves living here would have opposed our membership of the EU. But the mountain of bullshit that was built on the Brexit case had nothing to do with that. It was notional stuff about blue passports, about Spitfires. I mean, they couldn't even list it.
You could have just gotten some spray paint. Just paint your passport cover blue. Would have saved everyone so much trouble.
What they really meant by the blue passport thing was they wanted to turn the clock back. I mean, it was a metaphor, really. That the large, cumbersome, cardboardy passports that we used to have in the 70s and 80s, it was symbolic of the age when you could be rude about foreign people and make racist jokes on the BBC and, you know, sing along to the black and white minstrel show. The passport was a sort of metaphor for that age. It was symbolic, and that's what they wanted. They wanted the past back. But even that past was misremembered.
This, everything, at least from my opinion, that I see going on right now, Brexit is the biggest example of it, but also the Make America Great movement again in the US with Trump. And to a large extent, the Boris Johnson premiership is this huge attempt to turn the clock back, to shift us backwards in a way that is impossible because you cannot move back. A way of denying the reality that the world is even more interconnected than it ever was before, and that the artificiality of the borders that separate the countries is brought even more into question with social media and the communication revolution, all of these things, the information revolution, but you still have a section of the population that is ready to do, as you say, a monstrous act of self-sabotage to pretend that the reality isn't what it is, to pretend that we can go back to a time which they believe is better, but it wasn't better.
Yeah, I mean, that's why the last chapter of my book is called The Good Old Days Were Good. It's the biggest lie of all. Really, and that is the biggest lie of all, you know. And the idea that the British Empire even helped most British people is complete nonsense. British Empire made Britain, British people feel strong and powerful, but you still had children on the streets of England, you know, well into the 30s and 40s who didn't have proper clothes or shoes, you know, or a proper education. There was no healthcare. There was no state healthcare. You know, the Dan Hannan school of, wasn't it all fantastic? It wasn't fantastic. It didn't benefit British people at all, apart from a very small group, as ever, of very wealthy people who benefited from it. And, yeah, the good old days thing is nonsense. Even if you're my age, you can remember the 70s. The stark contrast between Britain and the declining Britain in the 70s, when London was sort of covered in soot and dust from the Blitz. I mean, everyone's forgotten it. London was a hellhole in the 1970s. Nobody wanted to live in. That world was so obviously worse than the world that we live in. But people want to believe it was better. And quite why that is, I don't know. Is it people getting old and lamenting their own youth? Is there some psychological thing going on? Or is it a sort of national sense of, and I think this is really a big part of it, what is Britain for? Who are we? Where is our place in the world? Yeah, we should be a big player. I mean, you know, this idea of destiny and stuff, which is common again to almost all countries. I mean, all countries, again, as I say in the book, all countries put themselves at the center of the map. But in Britain, it's turned up to the power of 11.
I think that to a large extent, a lot of this is some kind of vision of racial privilege, because during the empire in the UK, you still had the workhouses, you still had the poorhouses and extreme poverty happening in the UK. But the common person could still see themselves as being above in a hierarchy than everybody else in the colonies. So there is that that helped build this vision of British superiority. Yeah. And you have, like I said, a breakdown of this happening these days, because you have the world is more equal, there is more equality, and you're also able to see the world from your desktop, from your house. You're able to Google and see that you're not better off than somebody in a different country, that somebody who has a different skin color than you. So that questions your views, your perspectives of your idea of being superior. And that brings a nostalgic backlash, you know, nostalgia as a weapon, which I think has been deployed very successfully here in the UK.
Yeah, you're right. You know, even if you were very poor in Britain, you could, I suppose, at least think, well, I am part of the greatest empire in the world. And, you know, we rule the world and that's painted pink, which again is a deceit and a con against those very poor people living in Britain at the time, you know. And to some extent, that still plays out. It's a lot of the people towards the bottom of society still backed Brexit, didn't they? And sort of it's this sort of attractive lie of our greatness. And I think we're great. I think England and Britain and the whole of Western Europe does have great things about it. Of course we do. And actually, I think one mistake on the left is that the left doesn't talk those things up enough. You know, I personally find I'm often criticizing things, but I'm not putting forward what's actually good about the place. And it is, you know, the racial mix of the UK and particularly our big cities is an amazing, multiculturalism is a good thing. And people should be talking up rather than defending it.
So thankful to each of our listeners for engaging with our show. Remember to continue to send us any questions, ideas about future guests or future topics to enemiespod@gmail.com. You can also tweet us at enemiespod. Thank you to every one of you who has already rated us and left us a review or shared our show on social media. You are helping Enemies of the People grow, and every rating and feedback helps our visibility and ranking. So if you haven't yet, please leave us a review or rate us on iTunes and wherever you get your podcasts. It really makes a difference. You can also support us on Patreon at patreon.com/enemiespod. And now, back to our show.
I was speaking to Zoe Gardner, who is another guest in the podcast, and we were discussing in our conversation about the need to have a positive alternative, to imagine a new way of belonging, a progressive, positive way of belonging, of imagining the nation that in many ways we haven't been able to do. Because a lot of the time we spend defending things and criticizing things rather than putting forward a positive vision for what could be. And I believe that the right knows this very well, and that's why they keep on throwing out these culture war nonsense here and there to create more noise and more distraction.
You're right. The culture war stuff is exhausting. You know, the whole thing around the last night of the proms last year, when, oh, they've cancelled Rule Britannia and all the songs, and they hadn't. There was a pandemic on and people weren't able to sing. You couldn't have an audience in the Royal Albert Hall.
You mentioned Rule Britannia, and it reminded me that when I became a British citizen, when I was naturalized, in the naturalization ceremony, we all had to stand up while they played Rule Britannia.
That is really weird. Yeah. And you know, with Land of Hope and Glory, Elgar hated those lyrics. They were the very opposite of where Elgar sat politically. And he, so that distaste also, we also forget that whilst we say the people who lived in the empire period, you know, all bought into it, they didn't, they've always been critics of it. But those people get erased out in the amazing national narrative that the Farageists and Hannonists spin.
But that's another thing we don't talk about, is it? Is that there was always opposition to the empire. And it was never, you know, a fully accepted thing. Just like when we talk about racist things that happened in the 80s or the 70s or the 60s or 50s, even excusing some of the things that Churchill said, people tend to say, oh, it was a different time. It was all right then. But it was never all right. It might have been more accepted, but there was always people who were not agreeing with what was going on.
But Churchill's, and again, I put it in the book, Churchill's views on India, and he was absolutely against, steadfastly against Indian independence. They were totally out of keeping with the mood of the 1930s. He was very much seen as a figure on the right. A lot of most British people, certainly most people in government, had kind of come round to the idea of Indian independence in the 1930s. You know, the case was being made, but Churchill went against the tide and was seen as a bigot by a lot of his contemporaries. And the other really amazing and fascinating thing about Churchill, which cannot be said enough, is that he never really won, well, he never won the popular vote. So he stood three times to be prime minister, and three times he lost the popular vote to Clement Attlee. So in 1945, he lost the election. 1950, he lost the general election. 1951, he wins, but Attlee gets a larger proportion of the vote. Now, if Churchill had been this hugely popular figure that people would have us believe he was, he would have won easily, but he didn't. I don't think there was a prime minister in the 20th century who lost the popular vote three times, essentially.
I have one question for you on that. Churchill and Boris Johnson. The parallels are there, but not the way he wants them to be.
Joe, you know, writing and researching the book, I came to the conclusion there are a lot of similarities between Boris Johnson and Winston Churchill, and they don't shine well on either of them.
not flattering similarities, not the similarities that Boris Johnson would like.
I mean, they're endless, really. Both self-promoting, slightly buffoonish characters who kept being promoted into jobs because they liked the title, but they didn't really deliver the goods, you know. I mean, as Mayor of London, Boris Johnson did next to nothing. As Foreign Secretary, he was totally useless. And in the same way, Churchill as Chancellor of the Exchequer was a complete disaster. Churchill kept getting the gig, but he never quite delivered once he had the job. That was much of his early parliamentary life. And he loved to promote himself and he loved to get himself in the action. So during the Sydney Street Siege, famously, he went down when there were these anarchists or bank robbers or whatever, however you want to describe them in this siege when he was Home Secretary. And he made sure he was prominently photographed at the scene. Well, that's classic Boris Johnson. You can absolutely imagine Boris Johnson or Priti Patel doing that. And there was a huge uproar at the time, you know. There was an inquest subsequently, and a parliamentary committee meeting said, what was Winston Churchill doing at the scene? He was basically impeding the police efforts to catch these people as he pranced around trying to be caught by the photographers. So I think there are a lot of parallels. And I do also believe it's pretty likely that in 20, 30 years, when people look back on this era of the pandemic, Johnson will probably get a far better press in some quarters than he deserves.
As God forbid. Yeah. We're recording this the morning after England beat Germany in the quarterfinals, and people have gone insane.
I do wonder and worry, actually, that if England gets knocked out in the next round or two, there could be a very, very nasty backlash, because the mood in the country is already very disconcerting. I think it's partly the post-pandemic thing and partly Brexit and everything else that's going on. I mean, it's not too much of a leap to imagine it resulting in a riot if we get kicked out, as happened in 96, as I put in the book.
Well, the work that I do is on white supremacy in the UK and far-right extremism in the UK. And there is a very interesting Venn diagram that can be drawn between football fans and white supremacist groups. And even if there isn't, you know, and I'm not in any way suggesting that football fans are white supremacists, I'm a football fan myself, but there is an appeal that the England football team in particular has to white supremacist groups. And the imagery, the symbolism, the St. George's flag, which very much has been appropriated by hate groups.
Talk about the England flag, you get shut down. How dare you say that? You know, I mean, it's ridiculous. Of course, of course, the England flag has become a symbol of the far right. I mean, you know, it's literally the literally the symbol of the EDL.
Yeah.
You know? How people can pretend that it's otherwise, I really don't understand. Yeah.
Yeah, I feel very uncomfortable, to say the least, when I see the England flag flying. And in my work, I see it all the time being used as a symbol of hate, even though that's not what it was intended to be. And I see a lot of people talking about, you know, reappropriating the flag, you know, making it mean something else, taking its meaning back from the far right. And that all sounds lovely. I'd love that to happen, but it's not something that can just happen. There needs to be a lot of work to be done for that to happen, a lot of facing up to the facts for that to happen. And it's not a coincidence that all this language surrounding Germany and the Second World War bleeds through football when there are all these connections with hate groups, which is something that is not discussed. And I think until it is discussed, until it is brought to light, then it's always going to remain this extremely toxic and tense environment where not everyone feels safe. It's a crisis of Englishness, isn't it, that we're going through at the moment? Because if you look at opinion polling and everything in Wales and Scotland and in Northern Ireland, it tends to be much more on the progressive side of social issues than if you have the same opinion polls in England. So there is really a crisis of Englishness, of English identity and that English nationalism. And I wonder how much of it is tied to the loss of the empire, coming to terms with the loss of the empire, coming to terms with the fact that the nations of Great Britain are becoming more independent, even if they don't become fully independent. And then what is left for England? What is England without the empire?
Yeah, exactly. And a lot of progressive people in England might define themselves as being British or Londoners or Mancunians or something like that, rather than English. Because, as we've just said, you've got this uncomfortable thing around Englishness. So the space is left to the likes of the Tommy Robinsons to take control of that imagery and that identity. And then it becomes even more toxic for people like us to say, oh, yeah, we're English. I mean, I try not to identify my nationality at all. I don't go around going, I'm English. I don't think I've ever really said I'm English, you know.
Maybe it's part of that developing a new positive identity and a new positive vision for what is Englishness and what Englishness can be in this new environment. But also, I feel the same as you. I feel this tension to identify myself as English, to reclaim that identity. But at the same time, I don't want to be pigeonholed. I don't want to be limited by a boundary, by a nationality, just because of paper. Because that's what it is. It's a bunch of papers. It's paperwork.
Absolutely. I've just got the one nationality. But if you travel a lot, or if you have relatives who live in other countries, if you have a multinational group of friends or family, you don't go around defining everybody by their. And I suppose also with international travel in the 20th century, late 20th century, people perhaps became more aware of, I mean, I don't know, or maybe the wars as well, people just became more aware of identity. If you're a peasant farmer in the 14th century in France, you're not going to walk around going, I'm French.
What was France even then?
I mean, you're right, if there was a war, but I mean, nobody was going to walk around kind of proudly going, I'm from Belgium or I'm English or whatever. The notion of it didn't exist. It's a luxury of our evolution to some extent that but nation states are very, very odd concepts.
What is the one message you want people to take from your book?
The one message that I want people to take from in life is question things. Don't just take for granted what you're told. And don't just go along with what you were brought up believing. Because under that sort of veneer of history is a far more fascinating and interconnected history and far more interesting stories.
Thank you so much, Andrew.
Thanks for having me. Thanks.
That was journalist Andrew Scott. You can find him on Twitter at @Otto_English. His book, Fake History, 10 Great Lies and How They Shaped the World, is out now. Next week, we will be speaking with Zoe Gardner. Zoe is the Policy and Advocacy Manager at the Joint Council for the Welfare of Immigrants.
If you could describe the UK immigration system in one word, how would you describe it?
Brutal. Brutal is the only way to put it.
Remember, you can send any questions you have or episode suggestions to enemiespod@gmail.com or tweet us at enemiespod. You can also support us on Patreon at patreon.com/enemiespod. If you like our show, please rate us and review us on iTunes and wherever you get your podcasts. Believe me, every follow, rating, review, share on social media makes a huge difference for our show. You can find us on Twitter at @enemiespod. I'm on Twitter at Maria W. Norris. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll see you next time for more Enemies of the People.